Welcome to Indie Radio Garden. This week's highlights from community radio in the Philadelphia region.
This program brings ordinary citizens to the air to discuss issues related to health, race, safety, workers' rights, and the will to survive in pandemic times.
The first clip comes from WPEB 88.1, Scribe Radio's new show, Boxing on Brooklyn, hosted by Crystal Custis and Isaiah Gibson from West Philadelphia's James Shuler Boxing Gym. Their interview show focuses the discussion around boxing, entrepreneurship, and mental health. Next, we present an interview with John DeSanto, manager at Philly Boxing History.
Boxing on Brooklyn.
Ladies and gentlemen, for all of you in attendance and those tuned in from around the world, the event we have all been waiting for. Boxing on Brooklyn. Boxing on Brooklyn. Boxing on Brooklyn. Boxing on Brooklyn.
Today on our Rumble University segment, we have a very special guest by the name of Mr. John DeSanto. He's a boxing historian that created the Benny Briscoe Awards that honor many boxers in the Philadelphia area. He's the president of the PA Boxing Hall of Fame and the owner of PhillyBoxingHistory.com.
My name is John DeSanto. People call me a boxing historian, and I guess that I am that, but really what I am is a super fan who is just really interested in boxing, especially boxing history. And I've done a number of things to help develop that interest. I founded a website called PhillyBoxingHistory.com, and I moved it from just a website to a 501c nonprofit organization to do some other bigger projects. I also founded the Briscoe Awards, which is an award named after a Philly boxer named Benny Briscoe, and it is given to Philadelphia fighters and people who participate in the sport in and around Philadelphia. And I started that. I started Philly Boxing History in 2004. So it's been about 16 plus years. You know, there was some time I was working on it before I launched it. But I've always been a boxing fan and a bit of a historian in that, you know, I've just been fascinated with the older fighters and, you know, fights before my time. And so I was sort of an unofficial historian for a number of years and then tried to apply that interest to, you know, some specific projects that would, you know, help to, you know, bring information to people who want it, but also just to fuel my own interest in boxing. So that's basically that. I, you know, some of the things that I've done with, I know in one of your questions, Crystal, was, you know, contributions to boxing. And, you know, related to that, you know, I founded the website. I write about boxing past and present. I cover the current boxing scene as well. Created the Briscoe Awards and do a public event every year. So not only just award the fighters, but also to that's also to bring the community together and, you know, celebrate, you know, this sport that we love. Another program that I do with, through the website, through the nonprofit is a gravestone program. Years ago, I went to visit a grave of, you know, a favorite old fighter of mine, someone who, you know, was fighting back when I was just starting to get into boxing as a teenager, and, realized he didn't have a gravestone. And so I, arranged to have a gravestone placed for that fighter and turned it into a program, and I continue to raise money and do them every couple of years. I'll put a gravestone down and have done it. I'm working on my sixth one now, and it's amazing because they're old heroes of mine, people that I've read about and thought about and wondered, what they were like. You know, I've certainly read about them and I've seen some videos and old films of them, but in many cases they are, popular fighters that, you know, before my time, but I wanted to find some way to honor them. And recently, one of the more recent ones was Matthew Saad Muhammad, who was a fighter certainly of my time. He was one of the fighters that made me a huge boxing fan, because he was he's a South Philly guy, and he was one of the most exciting fighters ever in the sport. And I saw him fight at the Spectrum when I was a teenager, and always followed him. So that was the particularly exciting thing, to be able to put a gravestone down for him, just as a tribute. And the community pitched in and donated money, and so it was just an opportunity like that. Like, anything I could do to kind of keep people who are interested in this sport, try to bring them together, and together we try to create things that are positive and interesting, and ultimately to honor the past and the present of Philadelphia boxing. So that's basically who I am and what I do related to boxing.
John, that's absolutely impressive. I had no idea that you were involved in so many ways and so many aspects of contributing. I had no idea. So that just, heightens my respect for you and as a person, period. But also within the boxing realm. I mean, seriously, that's amazing. I don't know if you've ever sent that information to us, because I would like to contribute as well. Just knowing that in boxing, so many people go broke after they've won championships, after they a lot of boxers. It's a little bit different now because people are, because of social media, and people are branching off and doing other businesses outside of it. But a lot of times boxers are just fighters, so they don't have a lot of education behind them. They don't know a lot about the laws and signing contracts and completing contracts. A lot of them come from underserved areas. And so they already go into boxing with issues, and they may, fall back into whatever it is. I know quite a few boxers who, don't have money after they've had hundreds of thousands of dollars or even $1 million. It happens a lot across the boxing community, but as well as the African-American athletes, period, whether they're in the NBA or NFL or in boxing or what have you. But that's just awesome to know that you can contribute in way.
It's something like, I sort of stumbled upon it. I didn't really think much about it, but one day I was doing research in the library, looking at old newspapers, and I was reading about Tyrone Everett's death. He died at 24. He was shot and killed, and he was really in his prime. He had just 6 months before, he had fought for the world title at home, and by 99% of the opinion of people that saw the fight, he won the fight clearly, but of course got one of the worst decisions of all time. So, he brushed that off because he was such a talented fighter, and they were working towards a rematch. And of course, his future was bright, and he would certainly get his chance to win the title, as soon as he got back in the ring with this guy. He wouldn't let him get away this time with a bad decision. And what happened was, something happened, outside of the ring, and he was shot and killed at 24. So I was reading about that, and I always knew that. Like, when I was a young guy, I remember that fight. I didn't go to it, and it was, even though I grew up in South Jersey, I live in South Jersey, about 10 or 11 miles from Philadelphia. So we're literally right over the bridge. But I couldn't go to the fights at that age unless someone was going to drive me. And that person was one of my brothers, who was also he and his friends were boxing fans. And so they would take me along as a kid, but we didn't go to that fight, but I was really aware of it. And then when Tyrone Everett died, I was aware of that. So flash forward many, many, many years, and I'm sitting in the library reading about it, about all this emotion. Like, it was a very emotional funeral service. The line was around the corner, and everybody was crying, and it was just quite a scene. And it really made an impression reading about it. I didn't know about all that. So, I always say, I guess the good Catholic in me, I was raised Catholic. I said, let me go out to the grave and, pay my respects. So I went out, down the grave, found out where he was buried. He went to find his grave and couldn't. And the reason I couldn't was because there was no stone there. So I, you know, I got the map and I'm walking the coordinates and everything, but there's nothing there. And I talked to someone, they said, oh yeah, there's no stone on that grave. So right away it kind of like clicked. And I said, well, I can do something about that. So the first one, what I did was I just paid for it. I had to find his family and get their approval. But that's when I met his mother and his brothers. And his brothers were fighters also, especially Mike Everett, who fought for the title and was a great Golden Glove, you know, champ and stuff. But so I met them and they were really wonderful people. And they said, yeah, absolutely, they'd like to do it. So I went ahead, got the stone. And then that got a little bit of publicity, some newspaper articles and the local news. And then, you know, I said, I'm going to turn it into a program because what you said is very true. A lot of fighters passed away and they had nothing at the end. And the truth is that now when a fighter makes it, you know, they might make some really big money these days, but again, that's pretty rare. Most fighters don't get to the top, but even very popular fighters like Tyrone Everett, the next one was Gypsy Joe Harris, then Garnett Sugarheart. These guys were really popular, fighters, and they were, people who, you know, they made some money, but not enough. You know, they have brief careers and, you know, not enough to live on it. And so I learned that lesson that there's so many fighters had nothing at the end. And despite what they meant to people, there they were lying in unmarked graves. Now, it's not that important. It doesn't mean anything for someone. Like, a person doesn't have to have a gravestone. It doesn't change who they are and what they did. But it is something that it is a way to sort of honor them and do something. And it was, to me, I did it, you know, first time, there were selfish reasons too, because, hey, I idolized Tyrone Everett. I thought he was great. So when, you know, you don't get many chances to do something nice for someone that, you know, you care about that you never met, or like one of these are historic figures to me. So I wanted to do that, created a program, people donated a little bit of money, and then I would move on and I would hold fundraisers, or I would, you know, put out different things, ways to earn money. And I would do it. And I learned a lot, but the biggest thing about doing it, one was to literally put the stone down and, you know, honor them and get some attention, you know, for them, to put them back in the, you know, the newspapers. I remember when I did it for Gypsy Joe, there's a huge story in the Philadelphia Daily News about him getting a gravestone. So there's pictures of him in the newspaper again. You know, he'd been dead for many, many years. And so that was the thing. Remind people who these guys were and what they did. But what I didn't see coming for me was that I would create these connections with the family. And the best example of that is the Everett family, Tyrone's family. His mom has now passed away, but you know, she treated me so well. She loved the fact that I cared enough to do it. And, you know, his brothers have said, you're an Everett brother now. Like, we've officially, you know, welcomed you to the family. And I found that in most cases, that would be the case. I'm really close to the Gypsy Joe Harris family, Sugarheart, same thing. And but the other thing I heard a lot was, oh, it's, oh, isn't it terrible that these guys don't have gravestones? You know, there's some sadness there. But then I also heard that, you know, from, you know, typically kind of racist, you know, tone that's out there. People saying, oh, look, the first three fighters I did were black fighters. And they said, see, these black families, they don't care for their enough to put. And I said, this is not a black thing. This is a boxing thing. Boxing doesn't care.
The second audio comes from the first Scrap Radio workshop on the creation of radio content with gender perspective. A participant, Lois Volta, presents a history of feminism and its developmental stages in history.
Society reflects the people. How we live in our homes is important. Do we operate our homes autocratically? Or do we care for them in socially conscious, ethically minded, and holistic ways? Gender equality, awareness of environmental concerns, respect for diversity and the value of work. These things must be taught in the home. Awareness of our tangible domestic reality can serve as a teacher and guide for deeper states of conscious and societal healing. Today, I want to focus on feminism and what feminism might look like in the home. I figured I'd do a little breakdown on the different waves and phases of feminism. Sometimes it's nice to get a quick reminder of where we've come from. But also, you might not know, and that's totally okay. So I figured I'd do a breakdown. I encourage you to learn more and really let our history sink in. And it's our history, everyone, human history. When we let it sit in, we can make deeper connections to further understand why we are the way we are, why we do the things that we do, or how we raise our kids and look to the future. We can make connections by being allies in aiding female and human liberation by deconstructing our past. When we know where we came from, we can really place our feet down in the present and make conscious steps for our future. The first wave of feminism took place in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It emerged from an environment of urban and industrialism and liberal social politics. The goal of this wave was to open up opportunities for women with a focus on suffrage. The first wave secured a woman's right to vote, but also to own property. Just imagine being a woman right here and right now in 2021 and not being allowed to legally vote. Your voice, your beliefs, and your thoughts aren't even legally recognized. Imagine if you were living in a society and living under a government that does not validate your voice. The first wave brought women legal representation, which brings us to the second wave of feminism. The slogan, "The personal is political," is often used today. You might see it at rallies or demonstrations. And it's a slogan advocating women's rights. As a whole, the second wave can be characterized by a general feeling of solidarity among women fighting for equality. The first wave fought for and gained the right for women to vote. The second wave fought for the right for women to have access to equal opportunity, as well as the end of legal sex discrimination. Second wave feminism broadened the debate to include sexuality, family, the workplace, reproductive rights, just de facto inequalities, and official legal inequalities. It was a movement that was focused on critiquing the patriarchal or male-dominated institutions and cultural practices throughout society. Second wave feminism also drew attention to the issues of domestic violence, marital rape, and created rape crisis centers and women's shelters. It also brought changes in custody laws and divorce laws, giving women more rights. Third wave feminism sought to question, reclaim, and redefine the ideas, words, and the media that have transmitted ideas about womanhood, gender, beauty, sexuality, femininity, and masculinity, but it also redefined so many other things just about humans. Because third wave feminists embraced individualism. It also embraced diversity and sought to redefine what it was even meant to be a feminist. The third wave saw the emergence of new feminist currents and theories such as intersectionality, sex positivity, vegetarian ecofeminism, transfeminism, and postmodern feminism. And really, there are so many other types of feminism. The third wave kind of let all these different types of feminism bubble to the surface. The third wave is traced to the emergence of riot girl, feminist, punk subculture, and to Anita Hill's televised testimony in 1991. She gave a testimony as a black woman to an all-male, all-white Senate Judiciary Committee that the African-American judge Clarence Thomas nominated for and eventually confirmed to the Supreme Court of the United States that he had sexually harassed her. This was a huge case and really did so much for women. The term intersectionality to describe the idea of the women's experience has layers and layers of oppression, caused, for example, by gender, race, and class, culture. This was introduced at this time, and it was during the third wave that this concept really flourished. As feminists came online in the late 1990s and the early 2000s, they reached a global audience through the use of the internet, blogs, e-zines, magazines. They brought in their goals, focusing on dismantling gender role stereotypes and expanding feminism to include women with diverse racial and cultural identities. Then, the Me Too movement spurred on the fourth wave of feminism that we're in right now. Fourth wave feminism began around 2012 and is characterized by the focus on empowerment of women, the use of internet tools, and intersectionality, similar to the third wave, but the next step. The fourth wave seeks greater gender equality by focusing on gendered norms and the marginalization of women in society. Fourth wave feminism argues for equal pay for equal work, and that equal opportunities sought for girls and women should extend also to boys and men to overcome gender norms. So this might look like the encouragement for boys and men to express their emotions and feelings just freely by expressing themselves physically as they wish, and to be engaged parents to their children, and also to be participants in the equity of domesticity. The utilization of print, news, and social media platforms to collaborate, mobilize, speak against abusers of power in seeking for the empowerment of women and seeking justice against assault and harassment. These are the prominent themes of fourth wave feminism. Some feminists even say that the abuses of Harvey Weinstein and the women who spoke up against him were the catalyst and start of the fourth wave. Within all these movements, there has been pushback from men. Women have made men feel uncomfortable and threatened in each wave by pushing for equity and equality. Now more than ever, we need to support all people, to value all people with equality and equity. But we really shouldn't leave justice out of the equation. I'd like to make it a little personal, but before I begin, I want to preface that a lot of times I speak in broad strokes about cultural stereotypes of men and women. Let's pretend for a moment that there were two poles of gender, divine feminine and holy father. And I only speak about these particular two poles because it's a comfortable polarization due to how ingrained it is in the fabric of our global societal culture. Now visualize an arc from one of these poles to the other, and then back in its own separateness, then back again, and it eventually forms this infinite amount of arches that create this beautiful sphere of humanness. And within that sphere, there's infinite amount of poles. Gender is a spectrum, and its history should be deconstructed to create a new type of human, an equal human. With that said, no matter how you identify, you can ask yourself the question, are the men in our lives actually feminists? Are they on board with the fourth wave? Are they willing to look at how they've been part of the oppression of women by being born and raised in a patriarchal society? Oppressing and objectifying women has been part of how our global culture has taught and raised boys. Men, are you feminists? Are you an ally? Are you a friend? Are you willing to look at how you, yourself, not even knowingly, how you yourself have contributed to the need of an additional wave of feminism? Ride the wave, or you're gonna get hit by it. But these waves of feminism, they'll just keep coming, and they'll erode. You have to have faith that they will erode the patriarchal structure.
Thanks for joining us. My name is Latif White. I'm the operations manager from WJYN 98.5 FM Uptown Radio. Indie Radio Garden is a Prometheus Radio Project production.